for joining us. I'm Diane Rehm. A suicide bomber in Pakistan killed 7 at a top Air Force complex, and a senior military officer was assassinated by gunmen in Islamabad. The violence comes during a major assault by Pakistan's army against militants. In Afghanistan, election officials began distributing supplies for a runoff next month between the 2 top presidential candidates, and Iran considers a draft agreement to reduce its nuclear stockpile, but the outcome is far from certain. Joining me for the international hour of our Friday News Roundup, Moises Naim of Foreign Policy Magazine, Janine Zakaria of Bloomberg News, and Abdurrahim Fukara of Al Jazeera. Do join us, 800-433-8850. Send us your email to drshow@wamu.org. You can also reach us through Facebook and Twitter. Good morning to all of you.
Good morning.
So good to have you here. Moises, talk about this latest violence in Pakistan. What's happening?
This is a tragic way of debating policy. This is the way that the Taliban's have of telling the Pakistani civilian population that they will not accept and do not like the fact the military, that the Pakistan military are developing, deploying a very massive, very large military offensive in the tribal zones in Waziristan. This is an area that has been under Taliban control now for a while, and it shows a new, the government, the Pakistani government that had been reluctant and not that committed to take action against the Talibans in that area is now decided, is deploying more than 30,000 troops, is determined to take control of that area, and the Taliban are attacking all sorts of quote-unquote soft targets in the major cities, essentially to show the population that this will have consequences.
But, Janine, are the militants also attacking the military?
That's what's interesting. You had that very brazen attack on October 10th in Rawalpindi on the Pakistani army headquarters, which killed, I think, 20 people. And so they are definitely trying to send a signal, I think, the militants, to the Pakistani military, don't fight with us because we're going to come after you. So like Moises said, they're going after the civilian targets and the military targets, as the Pakistani military has deployed 28,000 soldiers to South Waziristan in this major offensive in the tribal areas, something the U.S., by the way, is definitely supporting fully.
So, Abdurrahim, is the military making progress in its campaign?
Well, I mean, it depends how you look at it. I think on the surface of it, they seem to be making progress. At least they seem to be toughening and firming up their resolve to take on the Taliban. And in that, obviously, they're pushed and supported by the Obama administration, which has, or at least some members of the Obama administration, have over the months said that the real challenge for the United States and for the international community is actually not in Afghanistan per se, it is in Pakistan. But having said that, that seems to be a self-fulfilling prophecy, because you focus attention on Pakistan, you bolster or you try to bolster the position of the Pakistani government. You hold them a little too close to you. Mm-hmm. That creates for them problems with their own public opinion inside Pakistan. And the Taliban in Pakistan seem to feed off that.
Moises.
The added complexity is that when we talk, when we speak of the Taliban, in fact, we are putting on the same name what is a wide variety of groups, organizations. They have different goals, they have different structures, they have different ethnicities, they have different sources of supply, of financing. Some of them are just criminals that masquerading for insurgent groups and religious groups. And they are drug runners, warlords. Mm. There is a variety of groups, each one has their own goals, and that makes it so difficult. In fact, in the current attack of the Pakistani military, they are targeting a very specific group of the Taliban's, the group of Batullah Masood, who was the leader of one of the faction of the pack, and that was killed in a drone attack, in a missile attack, and replaced by the Hakimullah Masood, and then there is another group formed by Mullah Omar and the Haqqani network, and that it's apparently not targeted at this point by the Pakistani army.
Now, I'm interested in the article that Jane Mayer wrote in this week's New Yorker magazine about these drone attacks and whether the U.S. is going to resort more to that kind of military attack, or, and maybe both, put more U.S. troops in there.
Well, obviously, there's been a fierce and heated debate within the Obama administration which way to go. But look, that seems to hark back to an old debate that the Bush administration had way back in 2003 in the run-up to the invasion of Iraq. And there were a lot of people within the administration who looked at the plans at that time, and they said even 130,000 troops going into Iraq, that's not going to be enough. We need to send in more troops. And there were others led by, at that time, Donald Rumsfeld, Secretary of Defense, who wanted to go into Iraq with a lean and mean force, so to speak. In other words, rely more on technology, on modern methods of warfare than on conventional ones. And the lesson from Iraq is that that didn't work. Once you come into contact with the insurgency, once you have to deal with the insurgency feeding off the support of the civilian population, then obviously modern technology doesn't seem to deliver. I think we're back at that particular argument now with Afghanistan.
With Afghanistan.
And with the added problem that has been acknowledged all the way at the top by President Obama himself, that these kinds of attacks, they create civilian casualties, and civilian casualties are an enormous challenge for the strategy that President Obama wants to pursue in both Afghanistan and Pakistan.
And Janine Zakaria, you've got sitting President Hamid Karzai finally agreeing to a runoff. Why did he finally come to that conclusion?
Well, as everybody saw, he had a certain amount of arm twisting by a certain senator, John Kerry, working as a de facto envoy on behalf of the Obama administration to persuade him to move ahead with the second round. It really wasn't an easy decision for him, as we saw since the August 20th election, amid the allegations of fraud. There was no willingness. And basically, President Karzai he crumbled under U.S. pressure and international pressure to move ahead with this. He had no other choice. Senator Kerry, speaking on behalf of the White House, made it very plain that the administration was not going to move ahead with more support for Afghanistan unless there was the phrase you hear everywhere now, legitimate and credible result of this election.
But how difficult is it going to be to hold another election in 3 weeks' time, Moises?
In 3 weeks' time, and under very different weather conditions. It's going to be snowing. The first election was in August 20th. This one is scheduled for November 7th. It took 160,000 people to run the other election, and it had 38% only of the Afghanis that took took part. Now, you know, there's, it may be that even less will take place. The logistics are complicated, impossible. The threats to people, people in some places get night letters, essentially a letter directed to you saying, if you go vote, we'll kill you. Mm. And all kinds of threats against people voting. So the sheer logistics of running this runoff election are going to be very complicated. And then essentially what I think is the aim is to have a power-sharing arrangement between President Karzai and Abdullah, who was the person that got the second largest vote.
Obviously, there was a determination that there was fraud, but even within the fraud situation in Afghanistan, Hamid Karzai was still ahead. Right. And now if there's a runoff, there is no way that Abdullah will be able to make up all that wide gap.
Because it was 34 that's to right. 52.
Yeah,
or 3.
That's right. Yeah, exactly. And now Karzai has the added advantage that in the runoff there will be only two candidates.
Right.
As opposed to the plethora of different candidates.
But couldn't that mean that Abdullah could gain that many, that greater percentage?
I don't think so. I mean, given the ethnic composition of Afghanistan, Karzai is from the Pashtun tribes of Afghanistan, and they still call the shots in Afghanistan. So I do not necessarily see Abdullah as a threat. The real threat, as Moses said, will be the logistics and the security to make sure that the runoff takes place in quasi-normal conditions.
So you don't see the possibility of a power-sharing situation?
There could be power-sharing situation, but a power-sharing mechanism where Karzai would be the intractable or play the intractable lead.
Abderrahim Fukara, he's Washington Bureau Chief of Al Jazeera Arabic. Do join us, 800-433-8850. Short break, we'll be right back. And just before the break, we were talking about the runoff election, which will occur November 7th in Afghanistan between Karzai and Abdullah. Whether Karzai gets a majority, whether there's power sharing. But the importance of that November 7th election to the Obama administration is crucial. Is he going to wait? Is President Obama then going to wait, Janine, for that November 7th election to decide what he is going to do with General McChrystal's request for 40,000 additional troops for Afghanistan?
The White House hasn't said definitively whether they'll wait till before or after November 7th to make the announcement. What's clear is that this dispute over the election and the results has bought the Obama administration some time to really think through whether or not to ramp up troops or, as we were discussing earlier, to go for an approach that takes less troops on the ground and more drones and more activity from the air. And I think one of the things you're going to have a problem with, though, is that it's going to take Karzai time not only to complete this election, but to build his government. And it's no longer going to be consequential. The White House is going to have to make a call on whether to send the 40,000 additional troops. My sense is that they're going to probably go for some sort of middle ground approach, which will not enable Obama to send 40,000 troops because members of his own party are calling for a timetable for withdrawal. And in that case, you could see a situation where there's a major shakeup of his military advisors, including McChrystal himself. If he doesn't get the 40,000 troops he requested, I don't see how General McChrystal stays on.
I agree. I mean, the challenge that the Obama administration faces here is really twofold. One, they do not have a good choice in Afghanistan in terms of whether it's going to be Hamid Karzai or Abdullah Abdullah. Abdullah Abdullah does not enjoy the kind of popular support that they need. Hamid Karzai is tainted with charges of corruption. Some of them are obviously justified. Some others hark back to the fact that he inherited a system. He's juggling pressures both from within Afghanistan and from the Obama administration. Now, that leaves the argument within the administration itself. Robert Gates is on the record as saying that he is extremely concerned about putting more boots on the ground in Afghanistan. The way he's framing it is that he doesn't want the people in Afghanistan to see the U.S. as an occupying force. I'm afraid a lot of people in Afghanistan already see the U.S. as an occupying force. But what he's really trying to say between the lines is that the more U.S. troops you put on the ground in Afghanistan, the more targets you create for the Taliban.
And meantime, you have former Vice President Cheney saying that President Obama is dithering.
And Vice President Cheney was this week essentially saying very strong things about how the current policy or lack of policy and decisions on the part of the Obama administration is endangering the nation.
Is that a fair criticism?
It depends. The White House replies that what I think in the words of Gibbs, who is the press, the media person at the White House, said that this is essentially President Obama fulfilling a solemn duty of making decisions with all the information and going slowly on decisions that are a matter of life and death for so many Americans. But it is a very strong debate. Vice President Cheney's comment are a reaction to a statement made by Rahm Emanuel earlier this week, where he said that when they got to the White House, they found that there was this 8-year-old war in which there was not a clear strategy, and they had to start it from zero because it was drifting and it was not sufficiently well thought through, and the strategies were not working. That was then what prompted Vice President Cheney's reaction. I want to add a major point that always is either not mentioned or a footnote when one talks about Afghanistan, and that is drugs. This week, the United Nations issued a report saying that Afghanistan's poppies and add to the heroin global supply something like $65 billion. And they are deeply, deeply embedded in all sorts of places around the world, major capitals. So in a country where the major industry is drugs, you cannot leave it as a footnote and leave it unmentioned. Mm. War and Islam and the country in Afghanistan is not, nation building is not the only thing that is going on. Drug production and drug trafficking and drug running, with all that entails, is also a very important factor that needs to be included in any conversation about strategies in Afghanistan.
All right, let's talk about what's going on in Iran with regard to nuclear talks. Abderrahim, earlier this week, Iran is said to have reached a draft agreement calling for about 3/4 of Iran's known stockpile of nuclear fuel to be shipped to Russia for enrichment to levels suitable for a peaceful reactor, but too low for weapons. Is Iran seriously considering this deal?
I mean, what's interesting is that they have been talking about the Iranians, that is. They've been talking about this out of both corners of their mouth, so to speak. You have some officials in the government who are actually mandated to talk about the issue saying, yes, this is a positive step. And then you have others, such as the Deputy Speaker of Parliament, who basically express a different sensibility, saying there's no way we would agree to that. And while that possibly tells me that there's division and there's a split within the Iranian leadership as to where to go with this baby, so to speak, it also indicates how agile the Iranians continue to be in terms of negotiating over the nuclear issue. I mean, these are first class, really first class negotiators who can make an issue, who can make negotiating over any issue drag on and on and on indefinitely. And if I may just add one thing, the one thing they know, though, is that the tide is shifting, because the Obama administration is talking about signs of the U.S. coming out of recession. Obama is already talking about disengaging from Iraq. And that must put long-term their long-term strategy under quite a bit of stress. They know they cannot make this, they cannot drag this on indefinitely.
Iran television is reporting that Iran is waiting for a constructive and confidence-building response to the clear proposal of buying fuel for their Tehran research reactor, and has often used counter-proposals as a way to draw out nuclear negotiations with the West, Janine.
Well, what's happened right now is you've got negotiators today, as we sit here in Washington, they're sitting in Vienna with the Iranians trying to finalize this agreement to ship out the low-enriched uranium from Iran to Russia. Meanwhile, Iranian state television is saying, we don't want to do that. We just want to buy it on the open market. We don't want to have to ship our stockpile out. So you're getting this sort of mixed signal that Abdurrahman pointed to. But what's key here to understand is when this deal was proposed on October 1st, the United States and its partners were delighted that the Iranians were going to entertain it, because what it would do is take out the material that they can use to make a bomb, take it out of Iran, and buy everybody some time to work out some sort of broader deal with Iran about its nuclear program. So if this deal falls apart, it's going to be a setback, and what you're going to see is a greater push towards sanctions.
What has Israel's response been, Moises?
They are paying great attention. They believe that these are more delaying tactics than actual negotiations. They feel that this is just delaying tactics, that the Iranians are just playing the game of appearing to negotiate in order. Meanwhile, they are developing their nuclear program. And so they don't believe, they hope, but I think, but they don't believe that there's going to be an outcome of these negotiations.
But meanwhile, Iran made arrests in the attack that killed Revolutionary Guard commanders.
And that is another perplexing story. This is a group it's the Jundallah, the soldiers of God.
Right.
It's a Sunni rebel group that is essentially composed of ethnic Baluchis. This is a group of Sunnis operating that live in Iran. It's an Iranian minority. They feel that they are discriminated against, marginalized, and repressed. We don't know if these attacks are just an ethnic group trying to seek send a signal, or there are foreign influences, as the Iranians are suggesting.
Exactly. They're saying that the U.S. and Israel were involved.
Well, if it was, if it was the United States, that would have it would be very hard to imagine that the United States would take that decision. It would not have been leaked. It's very hard to imagine.
Abdurrahim.
I think, regardless of whether the United States, Britain, Israel, and Pakistan are behind this attack, as the Iranians are saying, or not, what's interesting about it is that it draws attention to something quite important, which is that Iran internally continues to be a vulnerable country, not just in terms of what happened, the controversy over the election in June, July, and August, but also in terms of its ethnic composition. These are, as Moses pointed out, these are Baluchis. They are Sunni as opposed to the majority Persians in Iran. But having said that, we should not read too much into the ethnic vulnerability of Iran, because this is a much more cohesive society, unlike Iraq, for example.
But, Janine, while all this is going on, you have an Iranian-American scholar sentenced to a 15-year prison term.
Yeah, Kian Tachibagash was sentenced this week to 15 years, accused of working for the CIA, when in fact he is a Columbia University-educated scholar who works for George Soros's Open Society Institute.
Why is he targeted?
They have had a long history, especially I'd say in the last year or two, correct me if I'm wrong, of detaining Iranian-American scholars and Americans. We have, remember, there's three American hikers who are being held by Iran,
still
too.
Held.
You've got Robert Levinson, American, who disappeared and no one knows where he is, as points of negotiation with the U.S.
Janine Zakaria, diplomatic correspondent for Bloomberg News. And you're listening to the Diane Rehm Show. We have many callers waiting. We'll open the phones now, 800-433-8850. First to Lansing, Michigan. Good morning, Peter. You're on the air.
Good morning. Money, the politics, and war have been the driving forces behind history. And when we look at China, we see that they are intimately involved in very nefarious and unpeaceful actions in Guinea, and also on the economic front, they absolutely refuse to revalue their currency. Without the carrots and sticks of the Bretton Woods agreement, what can we do to help prevent this economic warfare that China is inflicting on the United States and the rest of the world?
Economic warfare, Moises?
Or pursuit of commercial interests, as any nation state would do. There is a long list of...
And we should say their GDP increased by 9% in the third quarter.
And becoming a locomotive, an engine for the rest of the world. So there is a long list of grievances that the rest of the world can level at China. But there is also, I think, in my opinion, an even longer list of good behavior on the part of China. During this crisis, the Chinese have behaved in a way that is competent and responsible. And in large measure, thanks to their policies and their recovery, and their, you know, they didn't go into a major slump, into a major recession.
So how did they get back to where they are? How did they achieve
They spent, Diane. The government's been spending billions of dollars this year to prop up the economy. But what they haven't done is created a consumer class within China to replace all the American importers who want all those Chinese goods. So they had to spend. And there's a lot of people who think that that 8.7% or whatever the exact figure was, close to 9%, is artificial. How do we know? Is that really right? So there's some questioning there because of, as the caller pointed out, the close nature of the Chinese society.
I mean, the connection that the listener pointed to between money and power, obviously that's a very powerful point that he made. I mean, they are clearly talking about coming out of a recession. Their economy is getting stronger. They have, even before the recession, they were able to compete with the United States, not just in economic terms, but in strategic terms in places like Africa. Now, he mentioned specifically the case of Guinea. And we know recently that the Guinean soldiers have committed some serious atrocities against civilians, especially women. We don't know to what extent or if the Chinese are involved, as he insinuated or not. But we know that they have traditionally, at least over the past couple of decades, tried to consolidate their power in Africa. Now the fact that they are actually ahead of the U.S. in coming out of the recession, That's what the U.S. obviously will be worried about. Its global influence, especially in places like Africa, Latin America, the Caribbean, where the Chinese seem to have invested considerably in economic projects.
I'm not sure if there's going to be that much worry, given the fact that we need the Chinese. The United States needs the Chinese to have money to buy our treasury bills, as long as we're spending like we're spending on everything. So they do need them to come out of it, and they're looking for some sort of way to work with them in areas like Africa. But when you talk to U.S. officials, there is no doubt that they recognize that China needs energy resources, and they're in Africa, and they want to try and shape the Chinese approach to these kinds of harvesting rather than stop it completely.
The fact that China, the fact that China is such a large country and such a big economic powerhouse sometimes obscures the fact that it's a very poor country. And that when we see the numbers are concentrated in a few cities and regions in the coastal area. And inside China, you have very medieval kind of realities with deep, deep poverty. And so China has huge problems of its own in
it's
internally.
It's got to create its own consumer society.
And that will not happen in a year or two.
Moises Naim, he's editor-in-chief of Foreign Policy Magazine. We'll take a short break. When we come back, more of your calls. Stay with us.
National broadcast of The Diane Rehm Show is made possible in part by the Kiplinger Foundation, supporting public understanding of business and the economy, by the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, committed to building a more just, verdant, and peaceful world. More information at macfound.org. And by the Pew Charitable Trusts, whose Subsidy Scope project provides information about federal subsidies across industries at pewtrusts.org. This is NPR.
On the next Fresh Air, the author and illustrator of Where the Wild Things Are, Maurice Sendak. He based the creatures in the book on his funny-looking older relatives.
My entertainment was to examine them closely. You know, the huge nose and the weird mole on the side of the head and how bad their teeth were. And they became the wild things.
Maurice Sendak on the next Fresh Air.
And in the international hour of our Friday News Roundup with Moises Naim, Janine Zakaria, and Abderrahim Fukara, let's go right back to the phones to Kansas City, Missouri. Good morning, Ron.
Good morning. My question deals with the economic development. I traveled in Iraq, and one of the things that I saw there was that there wasn't really, for all the billions of dollars that we're spending over there, there's not a lot of economic development taking place. So, you know, that's lacking. And my understanding of Afghanistan is that they are geographically located in what was known as the old silk trade that between the Middle East and Asia. And I want to know what's going on to try to redevelop that in the way of infrastructure with roads and railroads, which would allow them to have a place into the global economy, which should be the essential goal that the United States would want. So,
let's take Iraq first, Abderrahim.
Well, the issue of economic development, it has at least two impediments in Iraq. One is corruption, and the second one is political instability. Now, Prime Minister Maliki was here in Washington recently, and they're saying, both he and President Obama have been saying that Iraq is now stable enough to be able to start focusing on economic development. Now, that's one way of looking at it. The other way of looking at it is that the whole focus on economic development, as we have seen it talked about here in Washington during Prime Minister Maliki's visit, is that Iraq, which has sort of fallen off the radar here in the United States, is actually still not doing well politically. And talking about economic development is one way of diverting attention, people's attention, from the real problems that continue to bedevil Iraq. On Afghanistan, the issue of infrastructure that the listener alluded to, again, you have a similar problem. You have the problem of corruption in addition to many other problems. India, for example, has been involved in building or trying to build roads. And I think they have built a major road in Afghanistan. But that comes with a problem, which is any involvement, any Indian involvement in Afghanistan, it leads to Pakistani sensitivity,
right,
and it tends to ultimately complicate the problem rather than solve it.
Janine.
Well, you know, to echo what Abderrahman said, you know, Prime Minister Maliki came again this week, says Iraq's open for business, but it truly is not open for business when you still have the the political situation is volatile. We don't know what's going to happen with January elections, but the security issue is still paramount. You cannot, an American businessman or an international businessman cannot go and roam around Iraq and set up shop right now and import Coca-Cola and do all these things without being worried about getting blown up. Similarly, in Afghanistan, you've got a situation. I remember going to Canada to interview some soldiers there, one of our major partners in NATO, crying to me that they've tried to build this road. They were so proud of the road. And once they finished it, it got blown up by terrorists. So they are trying to build it. But there is no national road network in Afghanistan. I mean, it's just there's no way to do that. And until you have the infrastructure, as the caller pointed out, you can't have a thriving economy.
Moises.
Economic development is very, very difficult. Economic development in the middle of a war is impossible. So it doesn't matter. There's no country ever that has developed on the basis of foreign aid. You can pour as much money as you want, and unless you have a functioning market and investors and commercial activity, that will development will not happen. And it's impossible to have that if you have a war going on.
All right, let's go to Boise, Idaho. Good morning, John. You're on the air.
Hi, thank you very much, Diane. You have a wonderful show.
Thank you.
My question for the board is this. It seems that the United States has sunk a lot of blood and treasure into Afghanistan over the last 8 years. The countries that seem to have the most to gain from a stable Afghanistan, Russia, China, Pakistan, Iran, they also happen to be the countries that have sunk the least into it. A lot can be said for getting rid of a blank spot on the map where terrorists can have their training camps. But it seems that the countries that have most to benefit are also putting the least into it. Thank you very much, and I'll hang up.
Thanks for calling. Janine.
I just traveled with Secretary Clinton to Russia last week, and one of the things that was atop her agenda alongside Iranian nukes and sanctions was, what can you do, Russia, to help us in Afghanistan? And basically they said, well, we're contributing a couple of helicopters, and that's going to be our contribution. There is no appetite, no palpable appetite among the Russians to go back into Russia, and we all know...
To Afghanistan.
Sorry, into Afghanistan, given their history as former Soviet Union, and they see the Americans doing the heavy lifting.
But we continue to hear that NATO is going to contribute more troops.
And that remains to be seen. But one country that is seldom mentioned in the context of the consequences of a failure in Afghanistan is India. Remember that we are now talking about AFPAC, meaning Afghanistan, Pakistan, and that reflects the notion that you cannot talk about Afghanistan without including also the repercussions in Pakistan. Well, and if Pakistan becomes unstable, if Pakistan becomes a very troubled, even failed state, that has consequences for India. India is a pivotal country in the world today. It's with the largest world's democracy, is an economic powerhouse, is deeply integrated into the economic fabric of the world. If India gets destabilized by the neighborhood, everyone will pay consequences.
All
so
right.
Whenever you talk about Afghanistan, think India too.
Let's go to Wajid, who's in Canton, Michigan. Good morning to you.
Good morning, Diane. Thanks for taking my call.
Certainly.
My question is regarding Pakistan. Like, a lot of time, like, I hear your show, and all the time, like, people are bashing Pakistan. Like, it's all Pakistan's fault. It's all Pakistan's fault. But if you look, like, how much sacrifice Pakistan has done or in this war of terror, thousands of people have lost their lives in Pakistan. Thousands of soldiers have died. And look at the contribution of NATO on the other side. But Pakistan always gets, like, a negative media coverage. Nobody basically appreciate all their sacrifices, appreciate their whatever they are doing. Right now they are doing, like, 28,000 their troops. They kicked the Taliban out of Swat Valley. Nobody, like, in the media, no coverage regarding that. To appreciate this effort.
All right, Abdur-Rahim, how do you regard Wajid's comments?
I think part of what he said is absolutely spot on. I mean, Pakistan has paid a huge price for reshifting its alignment after 9/11. Before 9/11, they had actually helped create the Taliban in the first place, together with the United States and other powers during the fight against the Soviets, as we said earlier, and after that. But 9/11 came, and General Pervez Musharraf, who was leading Pakistan at that time, he was basically given some very tough choices by the Bush administration. So he was forced to try and change alignment and fight on the side of the United States in Afghanistan. The casualties that the Pakistanis have paid, both military and civilian, sometimes go unnoticed. The Obama administration has, on the other hand, also accused the Pakistanis of doing backhand deals with the Taliban. So I think they have been playing on both ropes.
Janine.
Yeah, I was just going to echo what he's saying, that they definitely have not made clear which side they are on very often. And there are examples of trying to accommodate Al-Qaeda and Taliban, but also work with the Americans. And one of the things that has particularly piqued people in Washington is that the United States has given billions of dollars in counterterrorism assistance to Pakistan, much of which gets diverted to their stance against India. And in fact, just yesterday, there were new requirements and restrictions placed on U.S. military aid to Pakistan to ensure that the aid actually goes towards the war against Al-Qaeda.
Janine Zakaria, she's diplomatic correspondent for Bloomberg News, and you're listening to the Diane Rehm Show. And now to Rochester, New York. Good morning, Vincent.
Good morning, Diane. So nice to be on your show.
Thank you.
And I want to commend you for the diversity of the panelists that you put on, especially people like Mr. Korn last hour and Al Jazeera on this hour. I really appreciate the diversity.
I'm glad. Thank you.
I was wondering if your panelists can, or your guests can give us some insight into, I saw a glimpse of a story about an African warlord, and I don't recall his name, but I guess he had some prominence, and he was pointing to the fact that there were no Afghans or Afghani-born terrorists involved in the attacks of 9/11, and it seems to me that, you know, our mission in Afghanistan was to go after Al-Qaeda, which doesn't seem to be prevalent anymore. And I was wondering if your guest could give us a little bit more, because I didn't get more depth of his point that he was trying to make, and could expand on that.
Abderrahim.
Well, I mean, if I understand correctly, the point that he's asking about is why did the United States invade Afghanistan when, in fact, most of the people who the Bush administration had said took part in the attacks on New York
from Saudi Arabia.
From Saudi Arabia. I mean, that similar argument raged on also with regard to the invasion of Iraq here in the United States at that time, as we all know. Why is the United States invading Iraq when there was no clear connection between Saddam Hussein at that time and the people who carried out the attacks? Look, the Bush administration obviously came to the American people and to the rest of the world, and they said Osama bin Laden carried out this attack, and Osama bin Laden is housed by the Taliban. I went to the Taliban and I said, either you give me Osama bin Laden or you'll pay the consequences. The Taliban said, no, we're not going to give you Osama bin Laden, so he decided to invade Afghanistan. The problem that the Bush administration faced the Obama administration continues to face today, because the Obama administration is now saying that Afghanistan is a war of necessity. He has a problem, obviously, with his base here in the United States. He has a problem with the Muslim world, especially after his Cairo speech, where he said he wanted to start a new page in relations with that part of the world. People are not convinced, are not always convinced, that it is a war of necessity. All so right. That is one of the challenges that he has to juggle.
Let's go now to Brewster, Massachusetts. Good morning, Bobby.
Good morning, Diane. How are you?
I'm good, thanks.
I would just like to make a comment on your guest, Janine. I think she made a point on the Chinese growth being around 8 or 9% this year, and she said that's somewhat inflated. But, in fact, the reason why their growth is so much this year is because they're putting a lot into infrastructure, such as trains, like high-speed trains and city infrastructure as well. And I think that that would be something that the United States could use. You know, we're talking about solutions to our own economic problem, and a lot of people feel that dumping $2 trillion into the financial institutions was the appropriate move. And, you know, we see the results that we're still having, you know, an increase in unemployment. Why don't we have something like a transcontinental high-speed rail system, such as, I mean, they have it in Germany. These things can run up to, you know, 260, 300 miles an hour. They run on magnets, so they're not only energy efficient, but they create energy, which has solved a lot of problems.
And Bobby, I think an awful lot of people are wondering the same thing. That is, what happened to all the money that was supposed to go into U.S. infrastructure to help the economy? Have these projects gone forward, Moises?
It turns out that a lot of the shovel-ready, as they called it, projects were not that ready. But it is also true that to build a transcontinental railway is not something that you plan and do in no time. I do believe that Obama is committed to have what they call green infrastructure. They will have, and it is already part of the budgets, and it is going to be part of their investment. One has to be also aware that this economy is growing. It might not have been as a result of massive investments in railways and infrastructure as China, but, you know, 6 months ago, all the headlines were saying that we were going to enter into a massive depression, that, you know, the end was near, that was going to take a decade or so to recover. And while people were saying that, the economy started growing again. So someone did something right somewhere. Now, do we need more infrastructure? Absolutely. Is China just growing as a result of investment in infrastructure? No. China is also growing as a result of a big push in
pouring money.
But other countries have poured money. And Spain has poured a lot of money and is not growing.
Well,
so they are doing something more than just pouring money.
And what does China's economy and its growth mean to the rest of the world?
As I said before, China has been the engine of the growth of other countries. A country like Germany would have not grown as much as it did, and it's important that a larger European country like that grows, were not for its exports to China. So China is buying from Europe, and China is becoming, China is exporting a lot, but it's also importing a lot.
Janine.
I just wanted to say that what I was saying earlier was that they are, I was trying to make the point he made, that they pumped all that money
Absolutely.
Into the bond. And one of the reasons, and that's inflated that growth number, and there is some, we don't know how transparent the number is to boot, but the difference is that it's a centrally controlled economy. The Chinese are a billion people strong, and they can say, we're going to do this, whereas if you ever tried to deal with the Amtrak, to get Amtrak, even the subsidies it needs on the Hill, it's a completely different process here.
Janine Zacharia, she's diplomatic correspondent for Bloomberg News, Moises Naim, Foreign Policy Magazine, Abderrahim Fukara, he's Washington Bureau Chief of Al Jazeera Arabic. Thank you all so much. I will be gone for the next 3 weeks, taking 120 NPR listeners on a trip to Egypt. I'll be back with you on the 17th of November. Have a good 3 weeks. Thanks for listening, all. I'm Diane Rehm.
The Diane Rehm Show is produced by Sandra Pinkard, Nancy Robertson, Jonathan Smith, Susan Neighbors, and Denise Couture. The engineer is Toby Schreiner. Dori Annisman answers the phones. Visit drshow.org for audio archives and CD sales, transcripts from SoftScribe, and podcasts. Call 202-885-1200 for more information. Our email address is drshow@wamu.org. This program comes to you from American University in Washington. This is NPR, National Public Radio.